History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they really don't have to go untold as long as people like you and me are willing to take a little initiative and ask a few questions and then invest the time to patiently listen as memories from long, long ago take on new meaning in the here and now. Our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. If you happened to catch last week's episode, you heard a 100-year-old veteran named Bill DeGeneres talk about following in his father's footsteps and enlisting in the Navy in 1941, several months before the attack on Pearl Harbor. But there was a lot more to Bill's story that wouldn't fit into our show last week, so we took that rare step of asking you to wait another week for the rest of the story. Among the things we're going to hear today are Bill's perspective on the end of World War II and what might have happened to him if the atomic bomb had not been dropped. We'll hear his memories of a good friend who did not come home from the war, what Bill experienced on his honor flight to Washington, D.C., and even the first story I can ever remember hearing from a World War II veteran, and I've heard a lot, about drunken frogs. A lot to look forward to today. If you missed the first part of Bill's interview last week, you can access that online at hometownheroesradio.com. You'll also find photos of Bill then and now, and even some of the remarkable artwork that he's produced in his life, including one piece that's part of the Smithsonian collection. We'll work into the rest of his story with a unique element of it that some of you caught last week. It was fairly rare for father and son to both be serving in the war. The odds were even longer for connecting with your dad in the Pacific, but that's what happened when Navy Corpsman Bill DeGeneres learned that his dad was on Tulagi when Bill was in the vicinity with the Marines.
I got permission to take an inter-island traffic over there. I've met him and stayed with him a couple of times, watched the movies on his boat while we're there. It was very pleasant, you know. And then we got, I don't know how long we were there on Guadalcanal, maybe, a few weeks or months or so. And we got orders that we were going to move up the slot, what they call it, to an island up there. And at the time, I didn't know who it was. But I told my dad when I wrote him a letter. We're going to be moving out and soon. And anyway, because we were getting all ready, and so he invited me to come see if I could get aboard his ship and go with him up there. You know, I didn't know it was going to be an invasion or we were just moving. So I asked my captain about that, you know, and he said, sure, if you want to go over there, go ahead with him, you know, take a little boat and go. Everything was pretty loose in those days. So I went aboard his ship, and a day later, we all got together and his ships got together, and there was LSTs and troop ships, I don't know, there was a few, running parallel to go up the slot. We left in the evening, and it was, it doesn't take too long to go up through there. In the middle of the night or early morning, still dark, we got general quarters. Everybody had to go out on deck. We all go out on deck and keep sailing, and I was on his ship there, you know. And pretty soon we hear this planes flying, you know, around. This plane went past our fantail and went across because there was two lines of ships going up. About that time, the LST across the way, maybe 100 yards or more, opened fire all along. It looked like a blowtorch coming out. It hit that plane and knocked it down, right? Just, you know, not too far from it. Kaploop. It was pretty bad because there was another plane. It, It was a torpedo plane came by and dropped behind this guy when he was shot down. There was another one of them. They said they were float planes. I couldn't see them. I just saw dark things coming over, and the flames from the rear, from the motors. You know, this second plane, it was fired on, but he had already dropped his torpedo, and he didn't get knocked down, but it hit one of Dad's ships, same type of ship. A four-stacker, and I saw that thing just blow up, and it was pretty bad. Yeah, there was a few of them. I guess a lot of them on that ship were killed. And my dad said, "Yeah, it wasn't his ship; it was one of his ships that was knocked down." So they lost a lot of that personnel. So and then after that, we went on up into Bougainville, and Dad got a shore boat, picked me up, and take me to where I was. To be bivouacked on Bougainville, down the southern part of Bougainville. Mm-hmm. That's it for that day.
I can see why you haven't forgotten that day. That sounds pretty memorable. And now this is going to be just a series of islands that you're spending the next couple years of your life on. And your job there is to take care of Marines if they're wounded, right?
Absolutely, yes.
When did you have to start doing that?
Well, not for a while yet. After Bougainville, we came back to Guadalcanal, and we weren't there for more than a few weeks. And they said, we're getting aboard ship, we're going on maneuvers. So the whole bunch of us, part of the division, got on two or three ships, had to climb the rope ladder to get up on that. What an experience that is. You know, you look down, that the water's a long way down below. So you learn to grab the vertical rope and don't put your hands on the horizontal rope because somebody's going to step on you. You know. But anyway, we went to a couple of islands out while we were out. They said it was in Iwetok or Kwajalein, and we went ashore and they put some beer in a couple of shore boats, and we had a beer fest on the beach there, and it was hot. And there was a funny thing that happened. One of the guys found there's a certain kind of crab in those islands. It's got claws like you wouldn't believe, and it's a big, big crab. Anyway, he found a crab and he stuck his rifle down there to poke the crab, and the crab grabbed the sights on his rifle and bent the sights. Oh, those claws were like 6 or 8 inches long. So it wasn't bad, but he grabbed him, just pushed him. So he got rid of that. But that was a nice experience. You know, he had a break in routine and stuff. We got to go out and swim that day and enjoy a little food and the beer that they sent with for us too. So we got back a warship after that, and well, I guess we visited another island. They were, from what I can remember, they were just planning maneuvers or planning what to do in case of an invasion. That's all I could see. All we did was get aboard and sit and wait for something to happen. You know, back to Pinochle. You know, so anyway, then we went back to Guadalcanal, waited for something to happen. Then we loaded up. After that, wasn't more than 2 or 3 weeks, I guess. We load up and several ships, and we took off. Where we were going to go, we don't know. They wouldn't tell us, you know. We just going, and there was several troop ships. I would say at least 4 or 5, and so it was quite a trip from, I don't know how long, from there to the Marianas. Get your gear together. We're going ashore. So we're getting ready, and all the shore boats were circling to pick us up. And so they came one by one, pick us up, and down the rope ladder we go again and get in the boats. And we went ashore, and as we're going ashore, we saw a lot of cannon fire. So anyway, we went into the beach, and ahead of me, there was a line of LCPBs that went into the beach first, and they were fired upon. I thought, well, we're going to get in that. But by the time we got in there, a lot of it had already moved inland. They pushed them inland, and there was mountain work that they were having to go up over and around. And about that time, there was a lot of aircraft coming in, and they were shooting missiles into the refetments or the defensive places that the Japs had. So I watched a lot of that, and there was no fire by the time I got there. It was already moved inland, so we all had to dig foxholes waiting for the next thing to happen, which not much of it happened. It all went inland. So what they did, they set up the aid station, and I worked in the aid station for 2 or 3 days, and then they put me in grave registrations because I had the dental experience, and they needed somebody to identify undefiable personnel, which I worked at for a week or so until they used me for other things after that.
And I've talked to quite a few guys who had that kind of duty. Some of them only dealt with a few casualties, and some of them thousands. But how hard was that to carry out that duty, knowing this is a guy that could have been you?
Well, not fun. Not fun at all. And the part about it was, that was about a week after we landed. They put me on registration, grave registration, where they were digging the grave sites and collecting body bags for them. And they were setting that all up, and I had half a dozen or a dozen unidentifiable bodies, and I had to chart their teeth, which would be to the best of my ability. The bodies were in not good shape most of the time, and it was kind of gruesome and smelly, of course. You know, it was not fun. And so that's what I did. And I found out one of my buddies had been killed ahead of me. His name, Herb Clark, was a good friend of mine. And I didn't see his body or anything, but I found out it was him, and he'd already been buried. And in fact, he was buried before the graveyard was established, and they had to go out and dig him up and bring him up, and they knew who he was, and so I didn't have to identify him. In fact, I wrote a letter to his wife. I got a permission to do that, and I sent a letter of condolences, best as I could do, to help his wife understand that he did have friends out there. Later on, after the war, she contacted me, and I went out and met his wife and his mother and father. They, I understand later, they had his body reinterred from Guam and brought to the States, and he was reinterred in and around the Veterans Cemetery there in Westwood.
Yeah. I'll ask you more about Herb Clark, because that really underscores all of this. So this is Guam, where you came ashore, and you're seeing what can happen, and then you lose one of your friends. You said a real good friend, Herb Clark. Is there something that you process yourself when that happens? That do you think any more about the possibility that you could be next?
Oh, I always thought that. I always was on the island. In fact, after my stint in the graveyard, they filled it up. They needed a corpsman for other duties. They put me on with a group of Marines every 2 or 3 days with patrol duty of the island. In fact, because at several times they had snipe attacks, there was still a lot of Japs all by themselves all over the island. As far as I remember, Guam was not a major target. It was an island, from what I found out later, for the elite of the Japanese for relaxation and comfort. They had a comfort island anyway. And there wasn't a great setup of resistance there. The biggest setup was over on Saipan and Tinian. They had a lot of work there to do. The Marines had a tough time. And so I had this call for every couple of days to go on patrol duty. And we had a couple of experiences of finding a sniper. And one time it was two snipers in the same place. And incidentally, we had a flamethrower with us. This was all on a little peninsula off the island called Arodi Peninsula. These snipers were sitting there, and there was a road going back and forth from the main town to different places. Main town was Aganya. So they wanted somebody to find out what's happening with the snipers out there. We went out there and located them. They saw us come in, sniped at us. And nobody got hit, but they moved the flamethrower up real close, and he cut loose and took care of that business right there. So that was pretty exciting. So there wasn't much left of them after that, you know. Oh. But that was just about all I did from then on until the island was secured pretty early, actually. I ran into a few of my friends. I had another friend who was a Marine, ran into a couple of times on the island. His group were sitting out. They were machine gunners. They set up a nest. And whenever they got any kind of information, there may be an attack or anything like that, they set up and try to stop it, you know. So I ran into him several times, and that's what he did. But from then on, there's not much else to do.
It's time for our first break, but when we come back, we're going to hear how Bill DeGeneres and his friends spent some of that time on Guam, the first story I've ever heard in which rubbing alcohol turned into ribbit alcohol. No amphibians were harmed in the recording of this episode. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.